At our RNRS meeting Thursday, someone referred to Josh's mantra that no Torah portion, every Torah portion is beloved, which I tend to agree with. There is one that frustrates me because it is used so often it makes it hard to preach upon, but they're all fascinating. And many adults, and more so B'nai Mitzvah students, struggle with the Parshiot of Leviticus because they're, if not esoteric, then archaic. They're about a sacrificial system that seems very distant to our age, though in fact they were among the first things that small children used to be taught, the premise being that children are innocent and pure and our sacrifices are pure. But the truth is, I find them fascinating and very easy to preach upon because they are rich, if not with allegory, then at least with symbology and metaphor. And I don't think that's wholly unintentional. I don't think that's a constructed thing of our sages over the centuries. I think that is inherent in their nature, that once we travel past the lifetime of the tabernacle and temple, our sages knew from a very early age that Torah could not be an artifact, but had to be revisited and re-understood in every generation. And I think there are a lot of prophetic and ethical and personal maxims that come out of the sacrifices, certainly through our sages' understandings of them. There were four significant components to sacrifices that I want to address today. There's the blood of the animal, the fat of the animal, the leaven that was not permissible on the altar, and the salt that was required on the altar. That these ingredients, or these ingredients, I should say, with leaven were excluded, but these elements of sacrifice are repeated again and again in each of the various and sundry sacrifices we're told about this week. So let's start with blood. I'm doing them in alphabetical order, but it works also, coincidentally, in alphabetical order. So blood is forbidden since the time of Noah, and you may have observed as you followed along, the blood is gathered and sprinkled on the altar, but never consumed. And that's the precept behind draining animals of their blood, both through evacuation and through salt, when we kosher them, when we butcher them, you have to remove as much of the blood as possible, which makes the meat very salty and delicious. So among our sages, Rabbeinu Bachya of the Middle Ages, writing in the Near East, says that blood is the essence of the animal. And God never permits us to eat the spirit of the animal, only its flesh. When God permitted Noah that Noah might consume the animals, it was because he had saved the animals, and therefore they became his perquisite, in some ways his possession. He had rescued them and therefore had authority over them. But only the flesh, the body, not the life force. And so Bachya, like all of our sages, tries to comprehend, tries to infer, what is the moral message of this? That we stay soft-hearted, merciful, and kind, he says. The personality, the spirit of the flesh is in the blood, says Torah in chapter 17. It's a very interesting concept. I mean, I don't think we understand it that way. We think of personality residing in the brain. In the ancient world, they thought of it in the heart or the kidneys. But it's a beautiful interpretation that the blood, in many ways, if you're a cardiologist or vascular surgeon, blood is the life force, is the motive force, the prime mover of the human. When it stops, our cells become starved for nutrients and collapse and decay. It's an understandable image. And I think the message, to an extent here, is that we have authority and dominion over large tracts of the world, but we ought to be humble about that. Avram Isaac Cook, one of the first chief rabbi of Mandatory Palestine, was largely a vegetarian. He would eat meat to honor the Sabbath, but on no other day save Jewish holidays. I'm not suggesting you be vegetarian, but I have thought about it every year on this parasha. I think one of the messages is that meat is, if not inherently unhealthy, which we do to an extent understand, It is not ours to consume willy-nilly. If you look at the prices of kosher meat, so it's like $12 a pound, you can get filet mignon, non-kosher filet mignon, for about that price. I don't think that's accidental. I think it sends the message that this is a sacred and special and dear, in both senses of the word, thing to consume, and you ought not take it lightly. The second item that resides on the altar and that raises questions of authority and moral consequence is fat. So repeatedly, there's a statement in Torah, especially in this parasha, all fat is God's. Which I sometimes in my notes each year I write, God loves suet. Does anyone know what suet is? Oh, when I worked at a grocery store, people would buy the suet. I don't know if they still sell it, but it's like a bag of tallow. I don't know if you're going to go home and like mix it in your soup maybe or make soap. I don't know what it was used for, but you can feed, really? Thank you all. You've helped allay my revulsion of 25 years ago. It's a little late, but it's interesting. Now, there's a sense among our sages, both Maimonides and later collections, that the fat is the richest, understandably, I think this is true, the richest of the elements of the meat, the most delicious, the best scented, the most powerful in our digestion and for our health in some ways. And certainly in the ancient world, having the fat was the most enduring of meals, much for the same reasons that we have an extreme sensitivity to sweetness, because it was rare and precious. So our sages understand this to mean that, well, this is a pretty sentence, but I'm also going to interpolate Maimonides' ideas on this. Generosity is a good quality. A person should be careful not to be a spendthrift to attain one's desires, whether it's food or drink or to give wealth to criminals or to have expensive garments made or scatter one's money in all the schemes that don't lead to reverence of heaven. That's in some ways contained in the message or the questions of Ecclesiastes. What is the nature of wealth and what is the nature of the good and how ought we spend our resources? But in the Orchot Tzaddikim, this passage that I'm sharing with you, a person who is generous, should not scatter one's funds for nothing or pursue desires which can only bring all sorts of evil. One should be very careful, but very liberal nonetheless, with the poor, to dress them, to feed them with the best. As it is written, all fat is God's. That Maimonides expounds that whenever you give a gift, whenever you make a donation to the synagogue, when you would make donation to the temple, if you were to pick your clothes for Shabbat, for the Sabbath, you should pick your best, your newest, your most fine things for the Sabbath, that you give both to ritual life and, I think, implied to the ethical life, your highest efforts. Because those are things that are God's, and all fat belongs to God, and all of your richness, all of your wealth, and not just material wealth, but the wealth of your personality, the wealth of your energy, your best and highest, are, if not debts to God, then certainly gifts that you can give to God. And the other thing that's interesting, it doesn't exactly fit in where I'm going, but I didn't want to leave it out, was our sages, among them the Vilna Gaon, that great sage of the 19th century, Vilnius, talk about, in the very next verse, it says, Chukat Olam, an eternal verity, an eternal ordinance, eternal law. And the Vilna Gaon says, even levet olamim, for the eternal house. So I got thrown off by that, and I shouldn't have been. It seems pretty obvious what that is. Well, actually, it isn't obvious. What do you think that means, the eternal house? That's what I thought, too. So I had to look further. He's generally talking about the temple. But obviously, it's also the house beyond our house. I think what it indicates is that there are certain verities, certain truths, certain essences and essentials of life that transcend us, that there is truth out there, and this aspect of all fat being the Lord's is intended to ever remind us that our best and our highest, our most true gifts, are undeserved, unmerited, are acts of grace, and they eternally belong to and will return to God. And therefore, in our lives, we are only leasing them. blood and fat, now leaven. So this is important for Pesach. I was teaching this in Judaism 101, and it took me a good, maybe it was 3 years ago, maybe it was 7 years ago, that I finally realized what chametz is. Because I would struggle as a kid, so you can use baking powder and baking soda as long as they don't have grain sort of stabilizers. So I think, you know, cookies rise, right? I mean, isn't that the point? When you make cornbread, you put in baking soda and it rises. So it's not rising that chametz is, it's fermentation. And chametz, more particularly fermentation of grain. That's why you can't wet your flour for any more than 18 minutes. That's why matzah is quickly bechipazon, rushed into the oven, because there are wild yeasts in the air. Side note, the German beer laws require that hops, wheat, and water be the only ingredients for beer. Yeast is not included, because when the laws were written, people didn't know that yeast was a thing. They just thought it was a happening, right? So leavening, this idea of chametz being a spiritual artifact is not a new innovation. It's quite old, at least 2,000 years, that chametz has a spiritual aspect, that this inflation of leavening, it corresponds to one's arrogance and pride, self-inflation. And the Rebbe of Kotzk, I want to put these two comments together, one of the, I think, second or third generation of the Hasidic movement, of the Hasidic revival, notes that you can't put honey, which is, we should understand to be date syrup. They didn't have apiculture in the ancient Near East. They had date syrup and leaven in the sacrifices. Honey is too sweet, leaven is too sour. That extremes do not serve God. Oh my goodness, I just realized something. And Maimonides says that's true. You should find the middle path anywhere except with pride. That less pride is always better. That anxiety and fear is on one side, and overconfidence might be on this side. You should find something in the middle. But with pride and humility, you can always, always go towards humility. There's no limit to how much pride, how little pride you ought have, and how much humility. I think that's the contention here, the connection. Don't self-inflate, but also don't be an extremist. Don't be overly wise, or you will be dumbfounded, as Ecclesiastes says. Don't think yourself haughty or smart or all-knowing. You have to have known unknowns. You have to be wise about what you don't know and struggle to learn, but also be happy to accept the wisdom of others. Listen and learn and change. I want to thank Ken for reminding me to include a verse or a line in our Misha Berach that had somehow been omitted for a couple months. And we changed the phraseology, and we're going to think through how that works. You may have heard it, our dedication to our troops at home and abroad. We added a new clause that I guess had long since been omitted. Change. Listen to other people's opinions. Learn from them. Grow from them. Adopt them when it suits you. Don't be extreme. Don't be arrogant. Don't live only on one part. Blood, fat, leaven, and finally salt. So we have the issue of not assuming greater ownership than we do. We have the issue of giving our best to God, and we have the contention that we ought not to be overwise or extreme. So salt. This is the answer to the question, why do we put salt on our achala? Because every sacrifice had salt on it. And both now and then, I think the image was that salt was it. Like, that was the best. That was the crystal champagne of the era. That was, if there had been rappers, they would have bragged about how much salt they had. So that was it. And there's a book called Salt, which kind of traces the history of the value of salt. And some other spices exist too. Pepper is among this. Certainly in our age, saffron can go for outrageous prices. That salt is the spice and the flavor par excellence. Unrelated but interesting to me, in Tom Clancy novels, there was a period I read a lot of Tom Clancy novels, which is even embarrassing to admit now, 20-some-odd years later. But like, he repeats certain things in his novels. I used to be able to do his voice, and every time someone on a Navy ship is making coffee, he says, the secret to good coffee was a dash of salt. And I thought to myself, that's probably the secret to concealing that you have bad coffee. I've never had good coffee that needed salt. But salt, you know, salt is the essence of the sacrificial system, the essence of our riches, the symbol of our best, again, like the suet. Why? So here's a totally different, it's a kind of inclusivity, at least in the Midrashim, in our rabbis and sages' telling of the issue. So the Yalkut Reuveni, which I couldn't find the provenance of, probably a medieval midrash, says the world is one part wilderness, one part settled land, and one part sea. Maybe, I don't know. They had a small map of the world at one point. And the sea said to God, master of the universe, the Torah was given in wilderness, the temple will be built in a settled area, what about me? And God says they'll put salt on the altar. That salt reminds us, at least in these midrashic understandings, I think it goes to the fat question of bringing your best, but in the rabbi's understanding, it reminds us that everything matters. Maybe not everything can matter equally at every moment, but there is no one, says Pirkei Avot, that does not have his time and no trait that does not have its hour. You got to look out for everyone. Everyone has something to add. Every animal, every plant has a piece of our ecosystem. Maybe it would be wise to be vegetarian more often, if not completely. Every person in a congregation has something to say. Everyone at work has something to teach you. Everyone you cross paths with at the gym or on the street has a gift and a blessing to offer. And Kabbalistically, they explain this, that sacrifices had pieces from the four sectors, the four levels of creation, the inanimate world, the vegetable world, the animal world, and the human world. That, therefore, it's offered by a human. It has animal, it has grain, and it has salt. Which actually is a mystical idea, but probably has a lot of factuality. I mean, I think it is a piece of the connection among all the parts of the world, among us, between among us, the animals, the inanimate, and the growing. Plants, animals, humans, and minerals. Oh, it's a sweet image. That the salt reminds us that everything is included. They say that of the peace offering, that some parts go to the altar, some parts go to the priest, some parts go to the owner. That you give your best, you recognize your limits, you recognize the boundaries of your authority, you recognize, like with leaven, that you are not perfect and that extremism doesn't serve you, nor, and certainly not extremism in pursuit of pride. And you recognize that everything has a lesson to bring to you. With mind open, with heart wide, and with enough humility, you can grasp more of those lessons.